Hi everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable episode number 121. Today we will be covering The Legend of Korra, season 2, episode 9, The Guide, and episode 10, A New Spiritual Age. So stuff really starts to kick off in these episodes now that we're in episodes 9 and 10. If you would like to contact us during or after you're listening to this episode, email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can contact us on Twitter as @re_watchable. You can write your comments on this post on Hypeable, and you can also visit us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. My name is Michal. I'll be hosting today, and today I am joined by Karen and Caitlin. We have a little bit of a smaller crew today. How's it going, guys?
Pretty good.
Good.
Good. So we're doing fun facts again. This is a thing. My fun fact is that I have a cold and I slept for 3 hours last night. So that's, fun is a relative word. So yeah. Karen, how about you?
That's rough. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It happens.
My fun fact is that 1 year ago today, I saw Eminem in concert.
Oh my
and
God.
It was amazing.
Yeah, we're laughing at you, Karen.
Yes. You know what? I don't even care. It's fine.
You're just basking in the glow of the year anniversary.
I am.
I just really like that Onion article that was like, Eminem freaks out having meeting boy dating his daughter who's raised on his music or something like that. And it's like, I can't wait to emulate Eminem in all of my actions. You know? He was like, no. Anyway, Caitlin, what is your fun fact for today?
My fun fact is that I burned my finger on a 350-degree oven last night while I was making cupcakes.
So basically, we're just like in pieces and like staggering toward the end of this episode.
Basically.
Well, the first episode that we're going to be covering, as I said, is Chapter 9, The Guide. This is where... yeah, things kind of start to come together. In this chapter, it's props to hashtag Team Tenzin's schedule because Korra found her way back to the Airbenders and now it's time to get spirited away. Unfortunately for Aang's kids, though, sometimes the cool powers skip a generation, and after Tenzin admits he's kind of a fail at connecting with the spirit world, Kai and Bumi help him realize that Jinora's got the spirit thing unlocked, and he might as well just chill out because nobody can ever live up to Aang's narcissistic expectations anyway. Thank you for that, Ariana. Also, some stuff happens with Mako and Sami and Bolin. And basically, which culminates in Mako getting arrested because Vera frames him for blowing up the cultural center thing that we're still talking about. How'd you guys feel about this episode? Karen, what about you?
I liked it. I liked both of them, actually. I feel like I didn't have a problem with Avatar, like, prior to this point in season 2. It was fine. It was nothing spectacular, but I think the last two episodes and these two episodes, it's definitely hitting the season into high gear. Like you said, unfortunately, it's on episodes 9 and 10, but sometimes that happens.
Yeah, I mean, we still do have a few more. This season is, what, 14 episodes? I think.
Yeah.
So you know, in Korra time, we've still got a ways to go. Caitlin, how about you?
When the first time I watched it, I didn't really like this season very much, but on rewatch, I'm finding I'm enjoying it more, and it could be that I'm watching them in chunks as opposed to week to week. So maybe binging is better for book two here.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think that some of the harsher edges are maybe smoothed over a bit. Although I know that, you know, Ariana and some of the others are having some trouble with this as well. Anyway, so our discussion points, we kind of start off with, you know, Korra heading back to the Air Babies thanks to hashtag Team Tenzin schedule. Ariana notes that she tears for dead Sokka, but he's very proud. We know he's very, very proud of Tenzin and his schedule.
Vacation Tenzin.
Yeah. I mean, he's probably like, dude, you like he's probably like correcting everything Tenzin does in the afterlife, whatever. But yeah, so were you guys surprised to see Korra get there right away? Kaylin, did you think that there was going to be like a longer, like Korra, like maybe going back to Republic City or whatnot?
I mean, it does feel a little surprising that she would go right to Tenzin, especially considering the way they left their relationship the last time they saw each other. So I think my first thought would be that she would go back to Republic City, but I'm glad she goes to see Tenzin because it makes a lot more sense when we see how things play out.
Yeah, and it does kind of feel like a remedy to what had happened before. Karen, what did you think of this particular reunion?
I really loved it, actually. I thought it was, Korra's going home. Korra realized that she had made some mistakes, and she went back to not only rectify those mistakes, but rectify her relationship with Tenzin. He is a very important person to her, and he has done all that he can to help her up until this point, and she kind of threw it all back in his face. And I think she realizes now that, Tenzin's not perfect, but he's a good guy, and she can't say the same thing about her uncle at this point.
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely something these two episodes hammer home, that not only is Unalaq just like the shittiest, he is the shittiest dad on top of it. There are just a lot of really shitty dads, and I seriously wonder about Mike and Brian's childhood sometimes. Not to project too much, but I think also something that was really cool was that Tenzin doesn't like he doesn't rub it in her face. Like he has that one line where he's like a little bit like, oh, I knew something was gonna go wrong, but he doesn't. He's definitely willing to like. It's not even like a, oh, Korra, I forgive you. It's like a, okay, we had a fight. We were both a little wrong, and let's move on. Which I think is nice, especially since Tenzin gets a little bit irrational later on in this episode. And so then we kind of get to see, the Airbenders and the Air Nation. Everybody kind of pitches in to help Korra and Tenzin on their journey to the spirit world. It was definitely very cute to see Kaya and Bumi like playing their part and being kind of I don't know, they felt kind of like ancillary representatives of like Aang and Katara to me a little bit, and that they were kind of paralleling or moderating some of what Tenzin was doing. Karen, how did you feel about this kind of group effort?
I thought it was really nice. I really like Kaya and Bumi, and I wish we could see more of them. I feel like we're just getting snippets, and the moments that the three of them have together as siblings are really beautiful, and it would be cool to have them stick around more. Obviously, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I would really enjoy it if it did. And I like the fact that they were there for moral support, that they were, I mean, there was a little bit of bickering, especially when Tenzin starts getting cranky. But I feel like, they were really trying their hardest to make this work because they knew how important being able to get Korra into the spirit world was. And so it was nice just to see them like calm and working together until things, really started to get out of hand.
Yeah, I agree. And then, we kind of come to this issue of Tenzin not being able to access the spirit world. So, Caitlin, do you have any theories on why that is?
I mean, we know it's really rare that anyone besides the Avatar could cross over. Like when we see Iroh later, we know that's really rare that that could happen, and Iroh is a very rare person. So I think there's some of that, but I also think that maybe Tenzin is just putting too much of Aang's expectations on his shoulders, and we hear over and over again that your emotions have the greatest power in the spirit world, and we see how much Korra affects things around her with her emotions. So I think maybe Tenzin, even just subconsciously, that need to live up to everything he felt that Aang wanted him to be was probably holding him back.
Yeah, I agree with that because I feel like he's very textbook. Like, he basically, you know, was told or read about how to get into the spirit world, and he followed it point by point by point. But there's a difference between doing that and when you're talking about, you know, the spirit world and being spiritual and just feeling it and doing it and letting it come naturally. And I think it's because he was so worried about getting every little detail right that he wasn't actually connecting to the spirit world with his own spirit.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I mean, I personally think that Tenzin's funny in that he kind of combines some of Aang Katara's worst traits, you know, which also have their benefits. But he is super, super, super stubborn, you know, and I think kind of he's not as creative a thinker as Aang is. I think he's more like Katara in that way. Not that Katara is like an uncreative thinker. I'm not on team bash Katara by any means, but I just think that he, you know, he kind of does go by the rules, you know, and he sort of expects that these things are going to happen. And in addition to the prayer, and you know, I think it makes a lot of sense that it's just kind of like, well, you know, this isn't meant for you. And I mean, I personally also like the idea that kind of this universe has different uses for different people, you know, so not everyone is going to be able to go to the spirit world. Not everyone is going to be able to bend. Not everyone can be the Avatar, you know, so that's kind of an idea that I'm into.
Yeah, I totally agree with that because I think Jinora being the one going into the spirit world is not only, you know, not only has its purposes elsewhere, but I think it was sort of to teach Tenzin a lesson as well because he was like, no, she can't do it. You know, she doesn't have as much knowledge as me. And he was put in his place because she can do it and she did it naturally. And I think that allowed him to kind of, you know, come off his high horse a little bit and probably make him a better person because of it.
Yeah. And I mean, it also kind of contains that theme of the air cloud babies kind of all having this pressure that I don't think was probably intended, but they all feel this intense pressure to perform up to their parents' standards. And a lot of the time they fail, or at least in their opinions, they fail. So I think that's really interesting to see that from Tenzin's point of view, you know, where he fails when theoretically he's the one who kind of comes most into what he's supposed to be doing to continue this legacy. In case you can't tell, my voice has now reached like zero modulation. Oh God. So Ariana also wants us to ask, more importantly, what or who was he really doing? That is Tenzin. All those days on end, he told Pema he was meditating. I won't lie, that thought crossed my mind as well. But Tenzin's a good, loyal husband. I don't think that he was doing anything other than maybe reading the sports section every so often and trying to meditate.
I just have this picture in my head of him just sitting there trying so hard, and like the creases in his forehead and his shoulders getting progressively tighter because it's just not working. And if he just does it a little bit longer, maybe it'll work. And maybe he needs to do the incense a little different or something. And I can see him doing that for days at a time and just getting so frustrated and then later trying it again for days on end. Like, I can totally see him doing that.
Yeah. You know what actually just occurred to me too? Like, just thinking about the spirit world as we see it in the next episode, it kind of makes sense that Tenzin does not have an easy way in because it defies any rules, defies any kind of logic. You know, there is no rhyme or reason literally to the place. And so it makes sense that Tenzin is just not tapped into that kind of thing. We also kind of have this issue of, you know, not issue, but this kind of opportunity that Jinora kind of, I think it's sort of been percolating a little bit through the season, but this idea that Jinora does have a super, super strong connection to the spirit world. She can see spirits in the regular world. She can encourage those spirits to show themselves to other people, and she can guide Korra into the spirit world. So do you guys have any particular theories? Caitlin, do you have a theory on why Jenora's connection to the spirit world is so strong?
I mean, just from a narrative standpoint, she's the closest to Aang's age when we saw him in Atla. So it sort of just feels like a coming full circle of the whole new generation being the ones to bring about the greatest change and that sort of thing. So in that way, it makes sense to me that it would be her.
Yeah. And Taryn, any thoughts?
I think just the fact that she's a kid, you know, sort of like what Caitlin was saying, is a huge deal because kids are so much more innocent. They believe a lot more readily. They haven't been tarnished by, you know, their life and the experiences that they've had. And not that I think that Tenzin is necessarily jaded or anything. I think he's a very positive, spiritual, soulful human being. But Jenora has this wide-eyed innocence where, you know, it's like I was saying before, it's not technical for her. It's just a feeling. And she just sort of knows how to make it work intuitively. And that's something that you can't learn from a book or from being told by somebody else. You kind of just have to be natural to it. And I really like that they decided to go in that direction and that Jenora got her little bit of time to shine here.
I think when you kind of say it like that, it makes a lot of sense then that it would be Boomy of the adults that there was a spirit to latch onto him and land on his shoulder, because he is the most like that as a grown up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's true, actually. So we also kind of have an issue that grows out of, you know, Jenora's ability, which is that Tenzin kind of gets jealous of his daughter. You know, he wants to be able to do this. This is kind of an ability that he has been striving for his whole life, literally. And Jenora just like is like, yep, yeah, hey, spirits all around, no problem. I just like do it. And I think, you know, not a parent, but we can all maybe sympathize with the idea of like trying really hard to do something and then somebody else is just like, ah, I got this. This is no problem. But you know, it's obviously different when it's a parent and a child. How did you feel about this, Karen? Were you, I mean, Ariana makes an interesting parallel to the fact that it's a little bit like how Boomy and Kaya must have felt. I mean, they kind of, well, they put that out in the show as well, but, you know, growing up with Tenzin, even though, again, like none of this is one of the things I do like about this. And I know these interactions got a good deal of flack, especially when it was airing originally, but I like that none of this is intentional, right? Like people are hurting each other without intending to hurt each other. Aang and Katara have proven to be very imperfect parents, you know, without intending to. And I love that manifests in this way. So, Karen, how did you feel about this whole interesting dynamic that now draws Jenora into it?
Well, speaking of like Boomy and Kaya and Tenzin and, you know, their parents and all of that, I can see where, you know, the flack could come in. I mean, we don't want to believe that Aang is anything less than perfect because we've grown to love him so much. But I think the more realistic the show gets, the better it is. And the fact that they've had all of these issues is very realistic. I mean, this is, you know, I'm an only child, but I know plenty of people who have siblings and they fight a lot and they do hurt each other, maybe even intentionally, without it being something that they're doing to really cut deeply. It's sort of just something you do. Unfortunately, I think that's just human nature. On the flip side of that, while I do understand it and I do understand Tenzin's jealousy, I got really mad at him and really frustrated during this part because literally the entire world is on the line and he couldn't step back and be like, okay, let's let Jenora try and see what happens. And maybe part of him was just trying to protect her and wanting to be the one to help Korra get through because he is older and more experienced and could potentially protect her, whereas, you know, Korra had to protect Jenora. But if he had just let his pride go early on, then they could have gotten into the spirit world much earlier and the issue of Unalaq already finding the bad spirit, I forget his name, you know, it would have been null and void. And obviously we can argue, well, where would the point of the episode come in? True, but just the fact that Tenzin wasn't able to let that go just was the first time that he actually really made me angry at him so far in the series.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, what makes it the roughest is that, like, I think we all know the feeling of having a parent disappointed in you, and, like, that's just the worst, you know? And, I, you know, that's definitely what Jenora's feeling here, and that's probably part of why she kept it a secret for so long. You know, I like that we can both sympathize with Tenzin and also being like, dude, you're being an asshole, stop it. Caitlin, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, I really feel Tenzin in this whole scenario because I grew up in a family where there were just very heavy expectations upon you, like through school, and I was the youngest, so I was living up, I felt like I was living up to both my parents' expectations and what my siblings had done in front of me. So when I would mess up or not do as well as I wanted, I would always feel like I was a disappointment or I had let my parents down, when in reality, when my parents found out, they were like, what can we do to help you and to make this better, to help you do better in this class or something. So I feel Tenzin and his frustration because I have felt that. But then I also think about Aang, and I know that if he were alive, he would not be mad at Tenzin for this. He would not be frustrated with him or anything the way Tenzin probably feels like he would be. So I feel bad for him because I picture Aang, and that is not the kind of person he was.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what I mean. I think that, like, nobody is coming into this with an intention to hurt, you know, or, you know, hurt badly anyway. You know, obviously some sibling back and forth, maybe notwithstanding, but I love conflicts like that where it's sort of just people are messing up no matter what they do.
It's just very human.
Yeah, it's very human, and it's very good writing because you have to orchestrate the characters in very specific ways that they can, so they can do that. I think that's pretty impressive. So Ariana literally does not care about Republic City. She did not write any discussion points about this. That's fine. But just in general, you know, I think it is kind of a frustrating plotline. I remember, like, seeing this and seeing Mako and Asami kiss and just, like, wanting to throw my chair and just being like, why? Why is this happening? Did you guys have any thoughts on the continued romantic relationship between Mako and Asami, which may now be at an end because maybe Asami believes Varric's very, very obvious lie that, or the very, very, very obvious lie that Varric has orchestrated that Mako blew up the whatever cultural center thing.
This would be so much more interesting if we were ignoring the romantic plotline, I think. Because there's enough conflict going on between Mako and Bolin and Mako and Varric, and to tie in that really poorly developed triangle of emotion going on, like, just, it really does not work for me, and it really drags the whole plot line down, I think.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree. It isn't, not that storylines have to be flattering on anyone. Like, I absolutely do not agree with that. But, like, this particular, you know, romantic plotline is just particularly unflattering on everyone. And it, like, you're right. I think it kind of does make you devalue the stuff that's going on with Varric and, you know, all that. When he, like, he makes pretty serious threats, you know, in this episode. And he's starting to shape up to somebody who seems to be, you know, quite formidable, and, you know, but it's like you almost can't pay attention to that because it's like, oh, but what about Mako and Asami, and Korra is going to come back, and oh my god, this is going to be crazy. Karen, do you have any predictions or any reflexive thoughts of hate, or are you cool with it?
Definitely not cool with it. I don't, like, hate it. I don't like it. I think that you guys are right that the romantic plotline here just brings the story down. I mean, there are so many more interesting things going on with every single character on the show, and yet we don't seem to be focusing on that. Like, I find Varric fascinating. I think that he's a really interesting character. I honestly do not know if he's a good guy or a bad guy. Maybe he's just a good guy who's misguided. Maybe he is absolutely evil. And I'm much more interested in finding out about that. And I really like, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Mako, but I really like how he just knows something is up. And he's willing to go to whatever lengths possible in order to find out and bring justice to what has happened. And that gets him into a bit of trouble. And I like storylines like that. It's just, it sucks that you have to wrap that up in with what's going on between him and Asami, because I feel like it's so back and forth and it's so instantaneous. Like, I'm with Korra, I'm with Asami, and now I'm with Korra, and now I'm with Asami again. And there's no emotion behind it. It's just like, let's shove these two people together. And that just is not working for me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I also, not to drag this out too much, but one of my least favorite things about this is how bad it makes Lin look at the end. Just that she's like, oh, well, we're arresting you, Mako, because clearly you are the bad guy here. And it's like, what?
Like, yeah. Because clearly the triple threats were telling the truth.
Clearly
they're reliable.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense. And it's like, I can understand if she would be like, you know, like, obviously it's not as dramatic or whatever, but like approaching him quietly and being like, look, we need you in. We need to figure out what's going on, whatever. But, like, this just does not seem like the take charge, like, whip smart Lin from last season. And I think one of my least favorite things about this season was that it just, like, obviously it didn't destroy Lin's character, but I think it was kind of a miss. It came at her from the wrong angle. Karen, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely, because, and I didn't say anything last time because I was like, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but every time we've seen Lin so far in this season, I've been really disappointed in her, because I feel like maybe the Lin from the very first episode where we met her would have been like, well, we're just going to arrest this person because, you know, rules and everything. And like, she would be that kind of person, but she's developed so much in the short amount of time we've seen her in season one. And I feel like she's really started to care for these other characters. And I would assume knows, you know, their true intentions and would think that there'd be something a little fishy going on here. I mean, it's clear those two lackey detectives are like super fishy, like so fishy. And the fact that she's just eating up everything that they're telling her is really frustrating. And I think you're right that, you know, they've sort of missed the mark with Lin this season, and I hope that going forward they can get back on track with her.
Yeah, for sure. Caitlin, any thoughts?
I completely agree. This is hashtag not my Lin. Like,
yeah, no, it's not great. And also, like, wouldn't it have been so much more dramatic if, like, Mako had, like, heard the threat from Varric and then, like, turned himself in and, like, you know, maybe, you know, to protect everyone else. And Lin would have been like, you know, officer, what are you doing? Like, and not believing it. And, you know, just like, I feel like this romance thing kind of makes it necessary because they have to, like, shock Asami with this information. So it's, I don't know, whatever, not a fan. Anyway, I think that's pretty much it for this episode. Let's go into our favorite scenes. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was just Jinora being Korra's guide to the spirit world. I think that was a really cool twist in the story, because in the beginning I was expecting Tenzin to just take charge and, you know, do it. And the fact that he couldn't was really surprising and gave him another facet of his character. So the fact that Jinora did it so easily was really beautiful, and I like the whole spirit world in general.
Yeah, plus special test. So, yay. Caitlin, how about you?
My favorite scene was just when Korra and Tenzin make up for the tension and arguments that they've been having, and they apologize and embrace, and it's really sweet. And I love their mentor-mentee relationship.
Would you say that they had some tension?
but not sexual tension. as Ariana would say.
That is not an image I know. Okay. My favorite scene-ish, it wasn't really a montage, but it was sort of Tenzin's like, bro, do you even spirit world? System of like scenes where they were, it was succession of scenes where they were going through and like Tenzin getting more and more upset and more focused on the small details. And you kind of are figuring out that something's going on. And it's, I think that's, you know, they kind of do a really good job of building tension, but also keeping it very light, which I found very deft. Karen, what was your favorite line for this episode?
Mine was when Korra was like, I thought your bell ringing was just fine talking to Milo, because I know you guys have been talking about there's going to be a change in Korra's character. And, you know, I think I'm seeing it, because I feel like Korra before would have been very hot-headed about everything and like, come on, let's just do this already. But she took the time to make sure that like Milo knew that he was doing a good job. And I thought that was really important to see her do that.
And he was so happy to get the assurance.
Yeah, and then he just starts banging on the bell like crazy.
Yeah, I think you can definitely see the cycle of messed up parental relationships perpetrating itself here. Caitlin, how about you?
So mine was after Jenora has the spirits reveal themselves and the one lands on Boomy's shoulder and he goes, oh, you are just so cute. I'm going to name you Boomju. It's short for Boomy Jr. Don't you think he looks like me? And Tenzin doesn't even look. He just deadpans. The resemblance is uncanny. Like sibling banter.
Gay adoption in the Avatar world. Actually, I don't like this, because every time he says Boomju, and he says it a lot, I think he's saying Boomju, like J-E-W, and I'm like, what is going on? What is happening? It just confuses me. My favorite line is kind of it was Korra's, like, spiel about, I won't go through the whole thing, but, you know, she's talking, Tenzin's like, tell us everything from the beginning. So in a very Sokka-esque way, she does so, and she goes, you know, and then I met the first Avatar, and then I realized I shouldn't have opened the portal in the first place, and now I to close it again. She says this entire ridiculous speech, and Tenzin goes, I knew this would happen. And I was just like, oh, Tenzin, you're so full of it, but I love you. Yeah, so I think that's our conversation on episode 9, or chapter 9. Moving into chapter 10, A New Spiritual Age. Oh, and I just got the play on age. Oh, that's so funny. Anyway, the synopsis for this episode is as follows. In this chapter, Jenora takes the Avatar into the spirit world, but this time when Korra throws a tantrum, everything falls to shit. Well, it's sort of similar to the other times, but there's just a lot more variables in this case. Jenora ends up in the clutches of Hector Elizondo and his library, and Korra has to have tea with, hold up, the real Iroh, to learn to keep calm the fuck down. Eventually, Korra finds Jenora, but it's too late, bro, because one of the evil waterbenders with a K in his name, that's Unalaq.
Which is a Q.
Yeah, which is a Q. It's always a Q. Well, no, it's not a Q for Tarlok. Oh my god. has got her, and so dumb Korra, in her desperation, opens the northern portal, only to be tricked once again as the giant evil bird flies off with a 10-year-old who is 10 times as mature and sensible as the Avatar. Korra then wakes up alone, and Tenzin freaks out for good reason, because her saris are whack. I love how Ariana uses language in ways that I would never think to do. Okay, so this was a really interesting, cool, bizarre episode. Karen, what did you think of this, seeing this episode kind of... this is not the first time, obviously, that we've seen the spirit world since Avatar, but it is our longest time here and our most vivid, for sure. So how did you think of the spirit world? What did you think of the spirit world? I'm sorry, guys. I'm all over the place today.
That's okay. I think vivid is the perfect word for it. It was really beautiful. It was definitely one of the most detailed looks we've gotten at it. And I think the episode overall was just really well done. I think it had a lot of spiritual and emotional upheavals, and a lot of times when Cora like figured out how to take care of herself, which I think is really important for her character. And, you know, we also got a lot of action, which I really enjoy. And I just think overall it was a really interesting episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Caitlin, what about you?
This episode has so many throwbacks to Atla from Hello, Iroh.
Like, yeah.
Spoiler alert, Iroh, and also the library. So there's just continuing all these throwbacks to the original series, which is continues to be something I really love.
Yeah. Actually, Karen, let's just get this out of the way. How did you feel seeing and hearing Iroh again?
Oh, man. I was not expecting it. It was beautiful. It was wonderful. Just his voice is so calming. And I was like, everything's going to be okay now, guys. Iroh is here.
Yep. And they do it justice. You know, they give him all these great lines. And, you know, I feel like they probably have like a binder full of wise quotes, and we're like, okay, pulling this back out down off the shelf in Nickelodeon.
Whenever Iroh spouts off a profound scene, I always think of the scene when Zuko is trying to give Sokka the the inspirational line and talks about making a clown sandwich. So that's what I kept thinking of when he was talking to Korra.
Absolutely, my mind goes to when Zuko's on his own and he's trying to give himself, advice from Iroh. And he's like, Zuko, you must understand yourself, to know yourself, to go through yourself, or something like that. And it's hilarious. Yeah, good throwbacks, good times. Let's move on to, Jinora kind of has kind of obviously a very central part in this episode, even though she's kind of not even in it that much, but you know, she is Korra's guide, and obviously her being in tune with the spirit world gives her some facilities that that Korra just doesn't have, namely not panicking. But you know, Ariana raises the question, like, would Jinora have made a better avatar than Korra? And that's a loaded question. Caitlin, what do you think about that?
I mean, she would be better suited to all the spiritual things that are going on this current time. But there is would she make a better avatar? That's a loaded question, but she's very useful for this type of issue for them to deal with, let's say.
Yeah, and I mean, we also have to consider the fact that she would be a 10-year-old at a time when, you know, Korra would still be around. Like, she might be, like, a revolutionary or something. Assuming that the situation would be okay, we'd have another massive war breaking out with another very young avatar, and I'm not such a fan of that. Karen, what do you think?
I think this is a really unfair question for the same reason. I think that Jinora is obviously a very good person, very good at the spiritual world, but like Caitlin was saying, that doesn't mean that she's not going to have her faults elsewhere. You know, maybe she won't be as much of a fighter as Korra is, which could also be a problem for the Avatar. And I think that a huge part of being the Avatar is, you know, they're not perfect. They're just people, and they have to go on this journey to learn how to become the best Avatar that they can be. And they're going to run into some issues and some problems, and they're going to have to figure out how to be the person that they need to be in order to keep the world safe. I mean, Aang went through that same sort of stuff. So Korra is hopefully, if the series is any good at all, going to go through that same sort of stuff as well. And I think if Jinora was the Avatar, she would have to go through that same sort of stuff and find out her weaknesses and make them stronger. So I think that Jenora would have made an equally good avatar. I think that that's just sort of like the avatar's job is, you know, you find out who you are and then you become what the world needs you to be. And she would have been fine, but I don't think, you know, it's fair to compare two different people.
Yeah, I agree. And I think fundamentally, you know, I would not really anticipate any given avatar being like perfectly suited to the situation that, you know, that they face. I mean, you would think that, what's his face? Roku, you know, would have been perfectly right. He grew up with the Fire Lord, you know, if anyone is in the right position to be like, yo, like, do not start this 100-year war. Like, wouldn't you think it would be him? And he still failed. So, you know, I think everybody kind of, unless their intentions are poor, I think that everyone fucks up a lot and does the best they can and, you know, moves things along in their cycle toward the world getting destroyed by Rava, basically. Nope, Batu. Batu's the bad one. There you go. Ariana also notes that she fell out of her chair when Iroh showed up because, yeah, and I understand. I really do.
The first time I saw this episode, too.
Yeah. I think there was a lot of, like, fist pumping for me, like, double fist pumping and just being really, really excited and yelling at the TV.
Yeah. I honestly don't remember, which is weird. I don't think I fell out of my chair, though. You know, there's also kind of, Korra has a very interesting sort of journey in this episode in that she you know, one of the things I love about this episode is that it's kind of, the whole thing is like a metaphor, you know, in that like this episode really gets like kind of the most, not the most of everything because the episodes coming up get kind of that way as well, but it's sort of diving into metaphysical territory where things are not, things are true, but they aren't what they look like. And, you know, so I love this idea that Korra becomes a child, you know. I think you could see that in positive and negative ways, right? Like you can say that, like, oh, she's being like super immature. And so, you know, she reverts to being a child in the spirit world. And I think that's valid, but you could also say that, you know, she is terrified and is still a young woman and is not qualified, not, you know, she doesn't have the experience necessary to conquer the obstacles that she's faced with. And in the spirit world, what that does is it takes on a physical manifestation, right, of her as this terrified, like, crying child. And yeah, I find that really, really fascinating. So Caitlin, what did you think about kind of Korra going little? By the way, fun fact, I think it is the same kid who does the "I'm the avatar and you got to deal with it" who does baby Korra in this episode.
I think for me, she kind of represents her own insecurity with the issue, and she kind of reverts to how this whole thing makes her feel, because the spiritual part of being the avatar is where she is most out of her elements, so to speak. So, like, she's the least comfortable dealing with this sort of thing, and for this to be like the big potentially world-ending defining issue of her time as the avatar is gonna make her feel insecure and afraid and essentially like a child, because in the cycle of things that are going on, she is a child, because this is like 10,000 every 10,000 years sort of thing. So it would make you feel very small. So she still has so much to learn and to become more confident. And when she gets that confidence and feeling like she can actually have a grasp on what she's doing, that's when she gets big again. So I feel like it's more of a representation of her insecurity, at least when I was watching it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it. Karen, how did you feel about it?
Definitely agree that it's representative of her insecurities. I think that came through really clearly as soon as she started to change. What I found really interesting was the fact that being a child allowed her to learn more. It reverted her back to sort of very, like, black and white, simple rules, and she saw the bird, and, you know, she picked up the bird and wanted to help it, and I feel like perhaps older Cora wouldn't have taken the time to do that. You know, she was so wrapped up in her mission and everything that she didn't take the time to slow down and learn, and so by becoming baby Cora, which was so adorable, by the way, you know, she was able to kind of slow down and realize how the spirit world worked and how she could use it to help her.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, Ariana notes something interesting, that she has a lot of memories kind of come back to her. Like, she remembers Iroh, even though obviously Cora has never met Iroh. She remembers the teapot, which I do think kind of suggests this connection that, you know, maybe she's not as like smart as a child in the spirit world, but she is more wise and more in touch with her kind of eternal parts of her. Also, you know, the spirit world is very different. It does look different. Ariana notes that, I think this is true. The only time we really see the spirit world in Avatar is, you know, when Aang does the solstice in season one and goes and sees Ko, and it looks drastically different. You know, this is like Technicolor, and that was very drab and dark. There were weird creatures, but not kind of as many, in a very different kind of way. I remain torn about whether or not I like it, because I was so used to that one. But, you know, like I said, I kind of like the metaphor that this adds. And maybe the spirit world changes from Avatar to Avatar. Maybe that's just what happens. This world is a wacky one. Any thoughts on that, Karen?
No, I hadn't actually thought about it. I was trying to remember watching this episode what it was like back in Avatar, and I can only get like brief glimpses of it. But now that you mention it, it does seem quite different, like different even color schemes and tones and perhaps the way it was drawn. I mean, this was very bright and beautiful, and not to say that the other one wasn't, but I definitely felt a difference. But I kind of like the idea, maybe, of the spirit world either changing over the years for whatever reason. Maybe it's reflective of what's going on in the world or something like that. Or perhaps Cora is just seeing it through different eyes and different experiences, and perhaps that's changing it for her.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Caitlin, you know, coming to this a second time, how did you feel?
I mean, I sort of see it as maybe when Aang went in, it was just a different part of the spirit world, because we do see parts of the spirit world that are very drab and dark and gloomy and overwhelming. So that doesn't mean they aren't part of the same world, but that they could be just different, like, geographical locations, if you can have that in the spirit world. Like, because Cora goes up the mountain and it's not really dark and gloomy and scary and eventually changes. So I don't necessarily think they don't have to, maybe they didn't even change. It was just different parts of the world too.
Yeah, that's a good point. We also have on Jenora's side of the story, we have she goes to what's his face, Wan Chitong, which is I think my favorite name in all of Korra and Avatar. The owl, you know, from the library, who turns out to be just as much of a dick as he was the first time, if not more so. He, you know, Jenora kind of seems to get the better of him, where she like shows him she gives him knowledge and whatever. But then it turns out that he is working with, what's his face? K-Man, Q-Man, Unalaq. Karen, apparently you sympathize with Wan Chitong. Do you still sympathize with Wan Chitong?
No, I mean, honestly, I can't remember entirely how I felt about him during Avatar. It's been a long time, guys. We've done a lot of things. But I can tell you definitively right now, I do not sympathize with him. He really made me angry, And he seems, for being a spirit, I don't know. And I guess there are good spirits and bad spirits. Like, I guess I always sort of viewed him as more neutral, and I don't feel like he's being very neutral. I feel like he's being greedy and a little corrupt, and it just really frustrated me that he was helping Unalaq.
Yeah.
Kind of feels like Vatu's influence might be spreading a little bit before the harmonic convergence.
Ooh, that's a good point. I like that. Yeah, that he's kind of like, maybe it's not even his, like his of his own volition. I mean, we do see like the spirits going back and forth like all over the place, you know, between good and bad, and it does seem that there's kind of to a certain extent it might depend on how much influence Korra is exerting. So I like that theory.
It could just be his prison is weakening as the time approaches, so his darkness starts going out a little more the closer they get.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that Wan Chitong is just a dick, but
also true.
I mean, you know, like that, whatever. We kind of need that. This episode basically comes to a head, you know, once we find out, oh, by the way, shout out to Professor Zay, who is still in the library, which is funny because I remember when they showed a trailer for season two at my first Comic-Con, when, you know, everybody had been waiting for the season for so long. And I remember when Wan Chitong showed up on the screen, like people went crazy in Ballroom 20. Like the screaming was unbelievable. And then, you know, and everybody was like, oh my God, are they going to do it with Professor Zay? And they did it with Professor Zay. They did it. That was, yeah, really dark. But, you know, Unalaq definitely, like, not just politically, he is like spiritually a bad guy. And to the extent that, he forces Korra on pain of Jinora's existence, not even her life, like her spiritual existence. He's like, her soul will be lost forever or whatever. Like, it's seriously dark stuff, you know, to open the other portal, which will help enable Vatu to get out. The mechanics of this are a little bit convoluted and complicated, but what do you guys think? You know, did Korra make the right choice? Like, she'd kind of had this spiritual victory, you know, with the Phoenix and with Iroh and kind of coming to clarity and bringing herself to her adult self. And then she gets into this fight with Unalaq and is, you know, is crushed on multiple fronts. Were you disappointed? Were you surprised? Caitlin, what did you feel?
I had this expectation that she would find some way around it. Like, she would be like, okay, I'll open it. And then she would do something else. So I was waiting for her to somehow double cross him in her agreement, and it never happened. But at the same time, I don't know that she really had much choice, because she went in promising essentially to protect Jinora, her guide, to Tenzin, who was going to come in. So Jinora kind of is her responsibility, so she has to do whatever she can do to protect her. So it's not surprising that she was double crossed, but I don't know that she really had much choice but to try.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Korra really was, you know, between a rock and a hard place in that situation. And she also, I mean, like, I don't know. I find it very hard to be angry at Korra in situations where she's so clearly trying to do the right thing, you know, and this is just like, she's just trying to save a friend, you know, and I can't, I can't criticize her for that. You know, I don't think it would be fair to. Karen, what did you think?
I agree with both of you guys. I think, you know, Caitlin, I was expecting her to kind of do something too that would allow it to negate, you know, whatever was going on, trick him and come out on top. Although I think it was clear, like, you know, in this season still, there's still more story to tell. So I guess it wasn't like completely shocking, but I was hoping Korra would be able to do something else. And while I can't blame Korra for what she did, I am a little bit frustrated just because the entire world is at stake here. And one girl's life is the thing that's, you know, making Cora make this decision. And I know that makes me sound like a terrible person, and I doubt I would be able to make this decision. So this is no reflection on me, but I feel like the Avatar at its essence, its job is to protect the world. And yeah, it would have sucked immensely if Jenora died or whatever, but you know, is that the price to pay for keeping the world safe? You know, clearly they're going to find another way to stop Vatu. Is that the...
Yeah, that's...
Okay, Vatu, from doing whatever he's doing, but at what cost? Like, will, you know, 10,000 people die because of that? So it's really a question of, you know, what's more important as a whole here?
Yeah, but I'm really going to blame the dude who is, you know, wrapping the 10-year-old girl.
Clearly.
In spirit, you know, glue and whatever.
Yeah, it's definitely his fault.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I think it's complicated, but I also think that, you know, Cora had no way of knowing what, you know, what the heck was going on, you know? And so I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that it is a complicated question, but I don't think... I would not say that this is a, I don't think, obviously Cora loses here, but I wouldn't call it a failure, per se. That's my opinion anyway.
I think that's a good point because I think she's learned so much in the spirit world.
Yeah. And you know, then we kind of have the last shot of this episode, which is just heartbreaking and horrible, which is Cora waking up and going like, I'm so sorry. And then Tenza's like, oh, what happened to my little girl? And it's like, oh shit, this is real. Like, this gets real. I think this might be the realest moment of this season so far. Yeah. Who has more Tenzin feels here, Caitlin or Karen?
I have some Tenzin feels. I wouldn't say that I'm brimming with them.
He was trying to protect Jenora from essentially having any issues. And then, of course, what his worst fear comes true. So I do feel bad for him because he wanted to protect his child and he couldn't. He was completely unable to do so and was helpless to her plight. And so, of course, he's going to be really upset. And Cora's response is just heartbreaking.
Yeah, which is also, I think, a great twist, right? Because normally it's like, okay, so, you know, Tenzin tried and tried and tried and tried and was nasty to Jenora and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, but then the right person takes Cora into the spirit world and it's all going to work out. And it so vastly does not work out, you know, that I find it actually really clever that they twisted on us like that. And they kind of definitely keep us guessing. Yeah, so that is the end of this episode. We're definitely starting to ramp up into further activity. Let's talk about our favorite scenes. Karen, how about you?
Mine is basically just everything with baby Cora. I thought she was really adorable, and my favorite line kind of goes hand in hand with that, so I'll explain further in a little bit.
Cool. And Caitlin, how about you?
Iroh showing up and being boss Iroh, because like, we're expecting a number of characters or hoping to see a number of characters who were younger when Atla was on, and then to see Iroh, that's like the last character you expect to see in the show. And it's just, he's such a beloved character, so he comes out of the shadows and you're like, Iroh! So MFing Iroh.
Agreed. And my favorite scene was just kind of on a, not on an emotional level, but on an aesthetic level. Well, it was emotional too, but I just loved the animation. And obviously that's something that's been a challenge this season, but that view of Cora and the Phoenix kind of transforming together into adults and riding through the spirit world, flying through the spirit world, I thought that was really, really lovely. Karen, what was your favorite line?
It's when Cora says, "It's okay, you can be my friends. My name is Cora, and I'm taking this dragon bird home." Oh. I just thought, yeah, it was really beautiful, and it was cool because she had been so afraid up until that point, and then she decided, you know what? No, I realize how the spirit world works. If I'm just kind to these other beings, then they'll be kind to me back. And it worked. I mean, those dog things transformed from the scary versions into the happy versions, and she continued on her way, and they helped her, and it was really beautiful, and I think very metaphorical for a lot of what Cora has been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Caitlin, how about you?
So
this is shock everybody.
Yeah, I was going back and forth between like Iroh cloud sandwich sayings for my favorite line, and I ended up with when he tells Cora, "Many things that seem threatening in the dark become welcoming when we shine a light on them." Because Iroh was just dropping wisdom bombs left and right.
Yeah. Gosh darn it, Iroh. My favorite line was Jenora. It was kind of two part. It was like Nora in the library looking around and going, wow, I could just stay here forever reading. And I heard that and I was like, that's my favorite line. And then Wan Chi Tong says, the last human who said that is still here. I see Professor Zay's desiccated skeleton. And I was like, now this is really my favorite line because it's both of those. Yeah, I really, really, I like that. I think, you know, I'm not sure how I've felt about this season as a whole rewatching it, but I think these two episodes definitely are stronger on rewatch. Anyway, we're going to move into some feedback, but if you would like to send us feedback and maybe be on a future episode of Rewatchable, you can contact us via email, which is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can comment on this post on hypeable.com. You can also reach us on Tumblr, if you dare to, you know, go into Tumblr, at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can leave us an iTunes review. If you rate us 5 stars, then Ive Smear, Karen will play with your puppy spirits.
That sounds very
nice. Is that a euphemism?
I didn't write it, so, you know, whatever. That's, yeah, okay. Okay, so getting into listener feedback, we have quite a bit. On Twitter, Susan Lyons, who is at Ruri Kaichu, sorry, says, the beginning is the turning point for the series for me. This is when it really got good. And yes, I agree. Like, beginnings, I'm assuming she's talking about last week, the episodes with Juan, which I agree were quite fabulous. Karen, you want to read the next one?
Yes, this is from Blaze Anderson at Blazy Ashley, and they say, P.S. I also shipped Cora and Captain Iroh when I first watched Legend of Cora. Fair enough.
Yes, I did too. Actually, no. I think I shipped him and Asami, actually.
Those would be some attractive children.
Oh my goodness, yeah. Some nice non-bending children. Actually, do we know? Is Iroh a bender?
Yeah.
Oh, he is. Okay, I'm an idiot.
He's a firebender.
Right, he's a firebender. Never mind. Caitlin, you want to take the comment?
All right. On the post from hypeable.com, Daniel Stewart says, if you watch, the reason Rava and Juan are joined forever is because during the moment of harmonic convergence, Juan reaches into the joined portals and absorbs the power. Vatu seems to feel the surge of power because he is touching Juan and recoils. I've always thought that there was a little bit of darkness absorbed into the avatar at that moment, which is an interesting thought. But there's darkness and light in us all.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
The physics of metaphysics is definitely a big theme in these upcoming episodes, and it gets, there's like a point where it's useful to talk about, and then there's a point where it's like, this is not useful to talk about. But we'll get there. So we have Natalie on a previous episode asked people to tell us where you found Rewatchable. And so we have a lot of discussions about that. Carl, I'm sorry, I can't read your last name, but it looks beautiful. Says, hi, everyone. Thank you for this weekend podcast. It is great to hear all of your thoughts on The Legend of Korra. You're quite welcome. None of my friends know about that show. Ah, I'm so sorry. So I'm glad to see that I'm the only one who loves the series and that the fandom is still alive, despite the fact that the show is over. I discovered your podcast via Hypeable. Google, who knows pretty much everything about me, this is true, and it is scary. Though I would like thought I would like this content, so I put it, so it put a link on my Google Now dashboard. That's creepy. I started listening last week, and I will continue. Awesome, thank you. Let's talk about the episode. This episode. First, am I the only one to have lately discovered that Avatar Wan is actually Avatar One, as in O-N-E, number one? Or maybe it was so obvious nobody brought it up. It simply occurred to me 3 weeks ago. For my defense, I'm French, so I don't always catch English puns quickly. What is funny, though, is that Wan means 10,000 in Mandarin. Yes, I think I remember people kind of joking about that when it came out. He was like, one, the first one, but also Wan is in like Wan Chitong, like 10,000. And Ariana also notes that she actually thought that Wan's name was Juan for the entirety of that first episode. And that is amazing. I love it. Hey, he could, be, you know, this is a very diverse world. It is an Asian-inspired world, but it is also a very diverse world. So I'm sure there is some Latin-inspired people there, too. Karen, you want to take Vegemiter. Okay.
Yes.
For a second, I thought that was a reference to Vita Vegemite or whatever it is.
I thought it was like a Dragon Ball Z thing. Isn't there like something? I don't know.
It's probably just a reference to that Australian
thing. Okay. Thank you. My bad. Anyway, I hope you like vegetables, Vegemiter. I discovered Rewatchable after I binge-watched Legend of Korra and went looking for best-of lists of Atla episodes to rewatch. I hadn't seen it since I was about 12, and all I remembered was that stupid Footloose episode where Aang goes to school. Fair enough. That is very memorable. I stumbled upon Ariana's article of Rewatchable Atla highlights and thought you guys sounded hilarious. Oh, that's amazing. Thanks to your podcast, I ended up rewatching all of Atla instead of just one or two episodes like I'd intended and gained a brand new appreciation for Bumi and Zutara. I mean, that is literally why we are here. So thank you very much.
It really is. Yes. Caitlin, you want to take the next one?
Sure. John Rakasa says, so how did I discover this podcast? I'm already a huge fan of podcasts such as The Daily Tech News Show and Nerdist, and I decided to look for something different, and that's how I stumbled onto this podcast. I believe you were already in the third book of Atla, which was great because I was able to binge watch your show. I basically listened to nothing but this podcast for several weeks until I caught up, which kind of sucks because now I got to wait a week. Wait a week for the next one. I also want to thank you for this podcast because Mondays suck. My commute to work and back sucks, but having your podcast to listen makes it so much better. I can't wait till you guys get to books 3 and 4 of Legend of Korra. And neither can I. I'll just leave it at that.
I keep thinking, like, what happened in season 2? And, like, literally coming up in a blank, but my mind automatically filling me in on, like, and this happens in season 3. And it's like, oh, you guys, I can't wait. But I also need to say that I'm super, super, super flattered that we were in the same sentence as, like, Nerdist. Because, like,
yeah. Whoa.
Talk about something different. Yeah, it's a little bit different. But thank you. And we finally, we have a comment from Luke, who says that he found out about the show through an Atla app. That's interesting. It had news and stuff. And one day, oh dear, it said, one day you pooped up. But I'm pretty sure he meant to say popped up. That's fine. maybe Ariana just changed it to troll us. Then I started listening. I guess he's talking about the app. Does not seem to work anymore, but I already found you guys, so who cares, right? That is true. You know what? That is what its purpose was, and it had served its purpose, and now it has passed on into the spirit world.
Hanging out with Iroh.
Yeah, and poop. Okay. all right, cool. So thank you so much for listening, everyone. Sorry for my voice again, but this has been Rewatchable. We'll be back next week with the next 2 episodes in the saga of The Legend of Korra. I am Michal.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Caitlin.
Thanks for listening, and bye.
Bye. Bye. Oh, we harmonize so perfectly at the end there, Caitlin.
Bye, bye, bye.